Let me say a couple of things very quickly before we move into the lesson. First of all, how grateful I am for the invitation to be here and to speak in this series of lessons. Our fundamental approach in what we're going to say, starting with the Bible class and working all the way through, is a philosophy that drives my preaching overall, and that is that I believe there's a text for whatever it is that we're dealing with. I preach topically from time to time, did so a couple of Sunday mornings ago, certainly a legitimate way to approach preaching. Don't disparage that in any way, but I find myself leaning more heavily on an expository approach and exposing what God says in His Word and making application of that, and that's what we're going to be doing as we move forward through the meeting, starting with our class this morning. In fact, if you want to turn your Bibles over to Matthew chapter 5, we'll be there in just a moment. I did spend 13 years in Denver, Colorado, and just moved to Bowling Green, Kentucky last August. A little bit of difference in the culture from one place to the other. We loved our time there, loved the brethren even to this day, and are grateful for that time. It has afforded some great opportunities moving to Kentucky, and that chiefly is having our sons so nearby. Two of our three sons preach full-time in Huntsville, and so that puts them about 3 hours from us. Our oldest son, who has done ministry work in Arkansas, is now working for Georgia Pacific and lives in Bowling Green. In fact, is leading singing at Lehman tonight, and so we're excited to have them nearby. And we're also grateful for that. Kathy was going to be coming with me. That had to change because we began to look at, she has become a farm girl since she moved to Kentucky, and we got chickens and we got a garden that's about to be ready, and felt like that we couldn't leave that behind, or she did, and so she's tending to those things, and it's a good thing she did. We had a bad storm overnight, and the chicken run is going to have to be repaired. I wish somebody would have video of her doing that, and if there is, I may share a snippet of that with you, although I imagine my oldest son's going to do all that work, but she's having to tend to that, and so I'm sorry that she's not here with me. When we think about the movement and the development of words, there is a term for that, and the term is etymology. Etymology speaks to how words have changed their meaning over time. And you can look at any number of examples that indicate to us how a word was used one way when it began and means something completely different, or it's morphed and changed in time. I was studying recently the word assassin. Do you know the etymology of that word? It comes from the early Crusade period when Muslim fighters would get high. And then they did this to steel their nerve to kill their rival leaders. And the term for that, an Arabic term, was hashishayin, which was hashish users. But somehow through time and the mispronunciation from place to place, and especially as English speakers got involved, it became our word assassin. I had no idea that that was the background of that word. But what is the word for how a word or a concept or idea has a fuller and a more complete meaning? It's a word that our writer Matthew uses in his gospel 16 times. He uses the word fulfill, but the one that you're probably most familiar with is Matthew chapter 5. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has just begun that sermon. The preamble, the introduction to that being the Beatitudes. He then speaks of influence in verse 13 through 16 of chapter 5, and then he gets to this idea that he says in verse 17, "Do not think that I have come to destroy the law and the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." He says that until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest stroke or letter shall be done away till all has been accomplished. Whosoever therefore annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall teach and do them, he shall be called the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And I say unto you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17 through 20. Even though that finds itself somewhat in the middle of our sermon, I believe that this is the key to the entire Sermon on the Mount. Now, when we approach the Gospel of Matthew as a whole, we understand that each of the four Gospel writers has a different audience in mind. And so he has a different purpose in writing. And Matthew is writing to the Jewish audience. In addressing the Jews, his mission is very simple. To prove that Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah that they had been looking for literally for centuries upon centuries. Now, because they were looking for a certain Messiah, a Messiah that had a certain political power in their mind, a military prowess in their mind, because they thought of him in a sense of a material restoration of and an independence that they did not enjoy. When Jesus came among them, they did not recognize him as the Messiah. Even though if they had paid attention to the prophecies that they rested so much hope in, they saw Jesus as the very one. Now, because Jesus is, and Matthew's intent is to show Jesus as the promised Messiah, you're going to see him bumping up against the religious establishment of the day. Throughout Matthew, you have Jesus confronting the scribes and the Pharisees, and more often you have them confronting him. And Jesus confounds them with his wisdom and with his truth. You may think of another occasion, and perhaps the more clear one, in Matthew chapter 23, where Jesus summarizes the problem with the scribes and the Pharisees. They were the custodians of the law, but they had abused the law. In Matthew chapter 23 and verse 2, Jesus says that the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. All things, therefore, that they teach you, observe and do, but do not do according to their works, because they say and do not do. And they bind up heavy burdens and they place them on men's shoulders, but they will not move them with so much as even one of their fingers. And they do their works to be noticed by men. I submit to you, that's Matthew 23, 2 through 5, that is actually the preview or the outline for the rest of the chapter. Everything else that you see in Matthew 23 is an expounding on those three main points. The religious establishment had a standard of righteousness. They taught a righteousness that the people were listening to, and so many of them had bought into it, that Jesus says was not true righteousness. And the problem was threefold, and I'm not sure how well you can see that, but the first problem was they had a double standard of righteousness. They had a standard for themselves and a standard for others. They expected others to do the things that they said that they ought to do, but they themselves did not feel compelled to do them. Aren't you glad that we've graduated from that kind of thinking? That there aren't folks who try to tell you that you ought to live one way and that it's wrong if you don't, and they themselves feel exempt from that. That was one of the problems of the scribes and the Pharisees. But a second problem was that they had established their own righteousness. The righteousness that they had erected or had caused to come into being was harder than even God had made. They had extra regulations. They made it harder to become a servant or a follower of God than God did. And the third problem was that they did their righteousness to be noticed by people. How tragic that these were people whose lives revolved around their religious activities, but their motivation for doing it was so that people could look at them and say how righteous they are. Now, Jesus is commenting on that kind of a righteousness. And that's why I think that the key to the Sermon on the Mount is in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20, where Jesus says, unless your righteousness surpasses theirs, you're going to be lost. Now, a statement like that gets my attention. When I look at what Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount, I understand fundamentally that he is not just giving commentary on the old law. There are some who say that everything before the cross belongs to the old covenant. That misses the point entirely. Jesus is coming to fulfill the law, to take it to its full and true meaning, to show us, to indicate to us what God is really after. And what he is teaching in his ministry, you remember in John's gospel in John 14, 26 and John 16, 13, was the very material that they were going to teach in the establishment and in the growing of the church. So what we read in Matthew 5 through 7 is New Testament doctrine. That Jesus is teaching while he's still alive and is going to be sealed by his death on the cross. Now, it is true for us to be able to say that Jesus came to fulfill the law in the sense that when he died on the cross, because he lived a perfect life. He was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin, Hebrews 4:15. He did no sin, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 22. He was without sin. He became sin for us who knew no sin, 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 21, Romans chapter 5. He was the sinless one who died for the sinful so that we might be made righteous. It's because of this that Jesus could hang on the cross and legitimately say in John 19 and verse 30, it is finished. He accomplished it. Now, as we think about that fact, what we come to understand is that Jesus and what he teaches in the rest of this sermon in Matthew 5, 21 through Matthew chapter 7 and verse 27, which is when he ceases to speak, he is showing us what true righteousness is. What we as the followers of Jesus need to demonstrate in our lives to be truly righteous. We've got to follow what Jesus says in this sermon. So what I'd like us to do is to walk through, and I think when we're done with this lesson, we're going to have the same response, maybe anew, that they had who listened to Jesus' sermon that day. I've been up to the Sea of Galilee on several occasions, and they take it, there's a spot that they suppose is the spot where Jesus actually preached that sermon. And I try to transport myself and to think of myself as one of the common people who's sitting in that crowd listening to Jesus preach that sermon. They had synagogues dotting all around the villages around that sea. And they could go in and they could listen to the scribes Sabbath after Sabbath or day after day, whenever it is they went in and they listened to the teaching that was done. But when Jesus got finished, it says that they were amazed at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as one of their scribes. Now here is why Jesus is on a mission of fulfillment. In fulfilling the law and showing us what God truly wants from us, he addresses three very specific areas of my life and your life. Number one, in fulfilling the law, Jesus addresses our hearts. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 through 48, as soon as he says, your righteousness must surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees, he immediately launches into six contrasts. It is a contrast between the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees and God's true righteousness. And the contrasts are going to be with regard to the subject of anger, verse 21 through 26. With the subject of adultery, verse 27 through 30. The matter of divorce in verse 31 and 32. With regard to vows in verse 33 through 37. In the matter of revenge in verse 38 through 42. And in the matter of love in verse 43 through 48. They were teaching, the leaders, were teaching very specific things about those matters. And Jesus says that righteousness is not enough because it does not go down to the heart where we live. And so what Jesus shows us is an inside-out religion that's a part of truly being righteous. And so you begin to look at that in specifics. There was what the Pharisees said. There was their idea that murder was wrong, but sinful anger is okay. Now, they didn't say it that way, but it's what they taught. In verse 21 through 26, you could hate your brother as much as you wanted to, as long as you did not exhibit that physical hostility to the point that you violated the sixth commandment. They were big in saying not to do that. But Jesus gets down into the heart and he says, you need to keep your anger from escalating. And he says there's three stages. There's that broad general feeling of anger. There's an anger that causes you to call your brother empty-headed, all the way to the anger that causes you to call your brother a fool. Jesus says you need to keep that anger from escalating. And so he gives some very practical suggestions to make sure that we esteem one another in such a way that we don't let that control the relationship. You think about what he does. He says, listen, your relationship with your brother is so important that if there is an offense and you realize that you are offending, that you take care of that. You go and see your brother before you even go to worship. And he's not saying lay out of worship for 3 or 4 months while you calm down. That's not the point. What he's saying is this is so important, this relationship, that even though God expects you to come and worship him, you go take care of that first before you go into worship. And then, you know, if there's a problem between you and your brother, you take care of that between you and your brother, your neighbor, and you try not to bring anybody else into that. You think the church has conquered that principle yet? Matthew 18, 15 through 17 perhaps is one of the most violated commands in all of Scripture. We actually do it in reverse, don't we? You know, if you have your brother's offended you, go and tell the church. And as they hear you, maybe someday, maybe, you'll go one-on-one to your brother. It's not what Jesus says. Do you see how Jesus gets down into our heart and what a challenge that is? Because there's a nature that we have. We want to feed that nature. And Jesus says your righteousness has got to go down deeper than that. How many tiny unresolved issues have mushroomed into wars that keep the church from growing because Matthew 5, 23 through 26, it's not practice. And so Jesus is saying a tamed religion has a tamed tongue attached to it. You know, James, in writing his epistle, seems to be reflecting all the way through on the Sermon on the Mount. And he certainly seems in James 3 to be looking back on Matthew 5, 21 through 26. Jesus says true righteousness causes us to get down into the heart and keep anger from growing into outward, into outward hostility. And then there's the idea of adultery versus lust in verse 27 through 30. This was the seventh commandment. You shall not commit adultery. And Jesus is saying, listen, it goes deeper than that. The scribes and the Pharisees were saying, you can look as much as you want, and so long as you don't touch. Had they forgotten that their hero, David, had looked, and look at the trouble that it caused for him. Jesus says, if you look with the intention of lusting, then you are committing sin. Now, tragically, there are some who, although this is reprehensible, have tried to teach and have believed something that Scripture is not teaching. You ever heard somebody say that since lusting is adultery in the heart, my spouse has been guilty of lusting, typically through pornography. And as a result of this, I am the offended party and I can put my spouse away and I can be married again. Well, there's some problems with this. For example, in 1 John 3 and verse 12, John says that whosoever hates his brother is a murderer. We're not going to bring somebody up on the charge of murder for hating their brother, sin though it is. And second, we have to ask ourselves to be honest in self-examination. 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. In the scope of our entire life, in our married life, if we're married, have we ever even once been guilty of lusting? If so, how many times does it take for one to be guilty of adultery, for one to be able to put their spouse away? But more importantly, and third, is that Jesus is about to deal with an exception to his law, God's law on marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and it has to do with a physical act. As we examine this idea of what the Lord's exception is, we go to Galatians chapter 5, verse 19 through 21. Fornication and adultery are works of the flesh, not just of the heart and of the mind. Don't miss what I'm saying. Those who are guilty of pornography, who are enslaved to that, and for whom that is a lifestyle that they are not trying to put behind, or are otherwise guilty of lust, their souls are in jeopardy. They're sinning against themselves. If they're married, they're sinning against their spouse. They're sinning against others. And most of all, they're sinning against God. But what our Lord is saying is that true righteousness goes deeper. It gets down into your heart and it controls it at the source so that it doesn't grow into that which the law condemned, that outward act. But then we go to a third area, and that has to do with their law of divorce versus God's law of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. By the first century, the religious establishment had come up with a certificate of divorce. And this was to shield a woman from the charge of adultery. When her husband put her away, she was going to be in a place in society where she couldn't take care of herself. She would have to be married so that she could be provided for. And so this was to keep her from being charged as an adulteress, which would have caused her to be put to death under the law of Moses. What they were saying is, men, you can be divorced as many times as you want, so long as you give your wife this writing of divorce. Jesus was well aware that there was a division among the rabbinical schools based on Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1, that there was a school of thought that said listen, for any cause of uncleanness means if she burns the biscuits, you can put her away and be married again. And then there was a more conservative school of thought that says that it was because of immorality that you put your spouse away. Jesus doesn't side with one or the other. He goes back to the beginning and he says, this is what it was like from the creation. A righteous man is not going to cause his wife to commit adultery. He's not going to put her away. See, Jesus is saying that in this scheme of things, all parties were committing adultery. And then Jesus gives an exception. Jesus is saying that a righteous man whose spouse has committed adultery is not causing her to commit adultery by putting her away. She already is. A righteous man cares about his wife and would not do that to her. What Jesus says in Matthew 5, 31 and 32 is parallel to what he teaches over in Matthew chapter 19, verse 9 through verse 12. Jesus is approached by the Pharisees on that occasion and they're asking him, they said, Moses allowed you to divorce your wife for any cause. What do you say? Jesus says, it wasn't that way from the beginning. And I say unto you that whosoever puts away his wife, except it be for fornication, and marries another, commits adultery. And when the disciples heard this, they said, Lord, if this is the way it is, it's better for a man not to be married. Jesus says that not all can accept this, but those to whom it is given. He's not saying, by the way, you can take it or you can leave it. Hey, churches 2,000 years from now, you can either teach what I say or you can do something else. This is just for the ones who can accept it. No, look at verse 12. Jesus says, and some were eunuchs from their mother's womb. And others were made eunuchs of men. And there are others who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Let him that can accept it, accept it. My experience is that there are a lot who can't accept that. We need to understand that Jesus is teaching true righteousness. Unless our righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, we cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Will you notice that this teaching is universal? It is whosoever. That this teaching is authoritative. Jesus says, this isn't one of the scribes speaking to you. I say unto you. This is a provision that one can exercise, but I don't see that one has to. Jesus is permitting this, but let's say that one's spouse is guilty of adultery and repents of that. Jesus is allowing this, but not mandating it. We also see that this is not a teaching that can be negated by other passages. People like to run to other passages to try to negate what Jesus is very clearly teaching here in places like 1 Corinthians 7 or 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17. We also see that the adultery continues as long as the new marriage continues to commit adultery is the idea behind the word. And certainly it is difficult. Jesus is saying that this is something that you need to deal with as my disciples. But what I want you to notice for the sake of this lesson is that Jesus is going down into the heart to where we live. But then fourth, I want you to notice that there's what Jesus teaches about vows, or what they taught about vows, and what Jesus teaches about integrity in verse 33 through 37. Jesus is not saying that vows are wrong. In Matthew 26, 63, Jesus is going to make a vow to the high priest. Vows were permitted, and oaths were permitted under the old law. But here's what Jesus is saying. You shouldn't need an oath or a swear or a promise to make your word valid and more believable. Your word should stand on its own. Your integrity should cause people to believe your word because it's coming out of your mouth. And then there's what he says in contrast to what they say about revenge. There's the law of revenge, as they taught it, versus this law of unexpected grace and generosity. Now, the way that the scribes and the Pharisees approached God's word, it played to the baser nature of man. Fracture for fracture, inflicting when inflicted, with no mercy on those who were guilty. Again, put yourself there on that day, up on the shore, as Jesus is teaching. And imagine looking at one of those scribes and Pharisees as Jesus says, if they hit you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. Or if they ask for your coat, give them your cloak also. Or if they tell you to go 1 mile, go 2. Or if they ask, don't turn away, give to those that ask you. What Jesus is doing is getting down to the place where he himself is going to demonstrate a response that's unexpected that draws men to God. Wish we could say more about that. I'm looking at the clock. What time? Are we done in 10 minutes? 15 till? Okay, all right, let's move ahead. There's the conditional versus unconditional love in Matthew chapter 5, verse 43 through 48. They were saying something that the law didn't say. Did you know that? The old law did say, you shall love your neighbor, Leviticus 19, 18. But there was no statement that says that you shall hate your enemy. And so Jesus sets up a contrast there. He says, on the one side, here is true righteousness. Here is God whose love causes him to give to everybody. His reign, his son, is for the righteous and the unrighteous. And then there's the other righteousness. And he describes it as being like the Gentiles and the tax collectors, an insult to the kind of righteousness that the scribes and the Pharisees were practicing. And Jesus is saying, who do you want to imitate? The Father in heaven or them? Who had a better insight into the heart of the law than the one who was in heaven when the Spirit moved Moses to write it? What Jesus does is he peels off the mask of superficial religion and he says, it needs to get down into your heart. If your religion, if your righteousness begins in the heart, then you're going to have the righteousness that God approves of. But then second, fulfilling the law, Jesus is going to address our motives. This is all of Matthew chapter 6, and it goes down into chapter 7, verse 6. Jesus deals with six areas of righteousness. And he is assuming that we're going to be doing all of these. But the problem with the scribes and the Pharisees is that their righteousness was practiced to be seen of people. He deals with their motives. They were doing all these wonderful things, but the praise, the attaboys that they got from other people who said, boy, you're so righteous, that was the extent of the reward that they got. Jesus says, if you practice true righteousness, then your heavenly Father is going to reward you openly. Does that happen sometimes in this life? Sure. But what we're most interested in is our Father confessing that us and our lives before all mankind on that great day. The areas included these. First, there were the alms. Alms were, yes, monies that were given, but also any act of kindness. What Jesus is saying is don't do your almsgiving to be seen of people. We're not guilty of that today either, are we? You ever heard of a term called the humble brag on social media? Sometimes we just can't help but the things that we do, that it gets shared, that somehow people know the kindnesses or the good things that we do for others. Jesus says, what's your motivation? Why are you doing that? God accomplishes so much good through our acts of kindness. We need to do it for the right reasons. Then he deals with prayer. When you think about prayer, prayer influences the heart, the mind, and the will of God. It reminds us of our dependency upon God, but the scribes and the Pharisees and those that followed them used it as a means of showing their spiritual superiority, as some means of eloquence. In another gospel, we have heaven's attitude toward that. You remember in Luke 18:9, Jesus taught a parable about some who trusted in themselves and that they were righteous and despised other men. Two men went to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. And the Pharisee stood and thus prayed with himself. He said, God, I thank you. I'm not like other men are, extortioners, swindlers, unjust, or as this tax collector. I fast twice in a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And Jesus didn't even dignify what that prayer's like. And he says, over in the corner, there's a man who wouldn't even so much as lift his eyes to heaven, but beat on his breast. And his soul, the extent of his prayer was, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. This man went to his house justified rather than the other. In my prayer life, which can do so much good for others, what's my motivation in it? And then there is the matter of fasting. You know, I'm feeling like through this quarantine, I don't know if anybody else feels that way, I need to practice a fast for physical reasons. We had our boys come up from Alabama, and Kathy cooked meals constantly, like she did when they were little and I was a lot younger. My metabolism was a lot faster, and I put on those quarantine 100 pounds. And fasting I have done for that reason. Have you ever fasted for spiritual purposes? Fasting is done to influence God. He sees that affliction of self. It also is to help us to have determination and focus in our spiritual lives. But so often fasting was associated with times of trouble and disaster. And so people in those times would be fasting and they would be tearing their clothes. They would be wearing sackcloth and ashes and they would be weeping and wailing. And if they weren't careful, they could be motivated to do it for those reasons. And so people would look at them and say, look at how spiritual they are. Something that had so much benefit was improperly motivated. Now, all six of these areas are in the same category, I believe, where Jesus is addressing motives, because he introduces all six by saying, do not do this for this reason. And so when we get to money, it's the same way. Money is such a powerful resource for good, but our motivation can be wrong in our relationship with money. And so Jesus deals with that. And he deals with how we must lay up our treasures in heaven. I wish I had time to go into this, but context is the best thing to determine meaning. If you would look or make a mark and go back and study this later, in Matthew 6, 19 through 21, Jesus is talking about money. Don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. And he continues that through 21. In verse 24, he says, no one can serve two masters. He'll hate one, he'll despise the other. God and money is what's under consideration. So what do you think verse 22 and 23 is talking about? The light of the body is the eye. You know what we do with that? We say, hey, be careful, little eyes, what you see. Well, what's he talking about in 22 and 23? There's a law of exegesis that says if you're talking about money in 19 to 21 and you're talking about money in 24, guess what you're talking about in 22 and 23? If your eye is proper with regard to material possessions, your spiritual life is more apt to be on the right track. But if you have a dark view in your relationship with money, an improper relationship with it, be careful, because there's a lot of problem in your spiritual life. That's what 1 Timothy chapter 6 says. That's what the rich young ruler could say, because an otherwise moral life was undermined because of his relationship with possessions. I want to make sure that I have a right motivation with regard to money, because I don't want to miss the kingdom of heaven. And then there's trust. In the area of worrying, we have the ability to trust God to take care of us, or we can worry. Jesus spends more time on this than he does on any other single subject in the Sermon on the Mount. But he's saying, what motivates you? Do you have the right attitude in relationship with God? And then there's judging others. We are so often blind in ourselves for what we can see so well in others. There's a Swahili proverb that says in English, chimpanzees laugh at each other's tail. The idea is they all have the same thing, but you can see better in the other what you can't see in yourself. Jesus is saying we need to pay more attention to ourselves in our lives and be motivated by trying to live the way that pleases God. And out of that, we can help our brother and sister much better. Well, look very briefly with me. In fulfilling the law, Jesus also addresses our lives. An overview. In Matthew chapter 7, Jesus looks at the life and he says, I'm concerned about the whole person and how you approach your life. A truly righteous life seeks. Matthew 7, 7 through 11. You know, this is one of the great promises of the Bible. I believe that if a person wants to find the Lord's will and wants to obey the gospel, that there, if they continue to ask and seek and knock, that God will find a way for that. Now, that doesn't let us off the hook if we're not the one who has the opportunity and we don't reach out to them and help them. But I believe that this is how God works. But also in my life as a child of God, I need to continue to seek God's will, to knock and to be dependent upon Him. A truly righteous life sympathizes. Oh, what a rare ability to be able to see life through the other person's eyes. Do you think that would help our society right now? If we could truly see things through the eyes of others. But then we also see that the truly righteous life perseveres, overcomes. You know, I've maybe a handful of funerals I've ever been to, did the preacher not preach the person into heaven? And I'm thankful that I've been to several funerals of those who were faithful Christians. But it's amazing to me that people can live, and I can know about that, and you can too. They lived all kind of a rebellious way, and somehow the preacher at the funeral somehow magically transports them to heaven. But Jesus says the way to salvation is narrow. It's a difficult way. And few there be that find it. The truly righteous life perseveres, does the difficult things, bears good fruit. You can judge, but you judge a righteous judgment. We can know by the fruits how one is living their life. And then the truly righteous life obeys. And this is how Jesus ends. It is truly a great overview of the entire sermon. We're building on one foundation or another. What foundation are we building our lives upon? In Matthew 7, 21 through 23, Jesus says there are some who call him Lord, Lord, and don't do what he says. And then he says, some are going to say, Lord, did we not do these things, these wonderful works, these prophesyings? And Jesus said, I never knew you. What were these people? Were they people who had deceived themselves? Were they people who were trying to deceive the Lord? But they made their decisions based on trying to follow God according to their way. So much more to say, but let me say this. The rabbis had counted 613 commandments in the old law. The scribes and the Pharisees had made some more important than the others. That's what Jesus is saying in verse 18 of Matthew chapter 5. But Jesus is saying, I have come not to abolish, but I come to accomplish the law. And here is what that's going to mean to your life as a disciple of mine. In fulfilling the law, Jesus addresses our heart. Don't just do the right things on the outside. Let it begin from the inside out. And in doing those right things, make sure that you're motivated by wanting to please the Father, that He'll reward you openly. And in fulfilling the law, make sure that you live a life that is characterized in the way that Jesus depicts in Matthew chapter 7. For these are greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Thank you very much for your kind attention this morning.